session number 9437, reel 3.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 3. When we were at Fort Aurelia, we were there over Christmas in Rome, and it snowed, which is extremely unusual for Christmas in Rome. A children's party was organised, and we were able to get quite a lot of supplies from various American organisations, but I seem to remember the entertainment was done mainly by the FAU, and an enormous repast was provided from somewhere. And after the children had had the entertainment and eaten all the food, some Americans discovered that this party was going on and how lovely it was and how they'd love to film it for propaganda back in the States. And they insisted that some more food was produced and the entertainment was repeated so that they could film it. Well, of course, the children were all getting they really were full, as they weren't used to eating enormous meals, and the entertainment was a bit boring the second time round, and we all felt it absolutely ruined the party, merely for the sake of the Americans to have some propaganda. That was rotten, I felt. We all felt a shame, because it had been a lovely party till then.
You probably had some very skilled artistic people in there.
Oh, yes. That was what's made it so wonderful. There were so many people with diverse and interesting backgrounds. Well, I suppose it applied in the army, but not so generally. The FAU, almost everyone had some interesting background and special skills.
Did you make your own music, you know, in the FAU?
Yes. Well, there was Douglas Terry, who was he was debating whether to be a professional violinist or not, but he decided against it in the end, but he was very interested in music. He had got his violin with him. He played occasionally. And there were Donald Swan, who was a marvellous pianist, and songwriter. He wrote songs too, and even then. And I don't remember anyone by name. Oh, yes, there was another, Armstrong. I can't think of his Christian name. He went on to do work with the... what's it called? The One World, you know. I can't think about that. That's stupid. I'm waffling. They were a very interesting crowd of people. Anyway, after I'd been there, well, it must have been fairly early in the year, Dr. Peter Early and I were selected to go to Rhodes. To the Dodecanese, because Rhodes was still held by the Germans then. The islands around Rhodes was held by the Allies. And there were refugee camps there of Italians and Greeks. So we had a very laborious journey together back through Bari I can't remember the name of the port, and then over to Egypt. And we were back in Mardi when the war in Europe finished. And eventually we went over to Rhodes on a liner that was designed to take off the German prisoners. And when we arrived at a Rhodes harbour, which of course is dramatic, it was very dramatic then in the war with the castle behind, all the Germans were up in the harbour waiting for the boat, and I noticed that the officers seemed quite well fed, while the actual German soldiers looked as if they were really starving, as did most of the island inhabitants, which were a strange mixture of Greek and Italian and some Turks, because of the island had been given to the Italians sometime between the wars. And so you got a situation where children spoke Italian, and I spoke a little bit of Italian, and would translate for their mothers, who only spoke Greek. But it was very dramatic coming into that harbour and seeing the Germans for the first time I'd seen them in any number.
They very subdued?
Yes. They'd had a very bad time on Rhodes because they were completely cut off for a long time, and the Italians and the islanders hated them. And although if you went off into the mountains, you sometimes found people who were still living fairly reasonably, the people in the towns were absolutely down to eating rats and cats. I had a kitten there. I don't know how I got it, but it disappeared and never seen again.
What sort of supplies were the relief agencies able to take through when you were there?
Do you know, I don't really remember. Mm. I didn't stay in Rhodes then. I went over to Scarpanto, as it was called then. That's the Italian name. Karpathos is the Greek name, where there was a refugee camp and that the FAU had been running for some time. It was on a part of the island that nobody goes to because I think the name Efialti means terrible wind, and it certainly was, and the water was brackish. And when people have gone back since and have said they want to go to Efialti, the islanders all look absolutely amazed. Why on earth do you want to go there? They say, terrible place, which it was. But anyway, they've got this camp there. And the army used to supply us with a tanker of decent drinking water once a day. But the ordinary water was brackish. There was a hospital there with all the usual things happening. But with the end of the war, of course, they were all expecting to be able to be taken back to their own islands or where they've come from. And that did happen after I got there. The work gradually subsided. While I was there, there were some Indian army on the island and a few British as well. But a Greek corvette came into the harbour. What was it? Something beginning with P, the main town. And they were unloading this ammunition, and there was, I think it was probably because the harbour roads round were cobbled. Anyway, something exploded, and there was a very bad explosion. About five Greeks were killed and two or three Indians, and a large number of people were injured. And this Greek corvette ferried them over to Rhodes, and I did go with them. There were quite a lot of other people who went. An FAU doctor, what was his name? Mills. Can't think of his Christian name. He was there. And we took them to a hospital which was fairly well organized. There were two hospitals. There was a military hospital and a civilian hospital, and we took the patients there. I felt seasick, and they put me to bed. So after I'd... I don't usually feel seasick after I'd given... We were giving them all TAB injections.
Were they very badly burned?
Oh, some of them were badly, very badly injured. A lot of fractures and burns. Not so many burns, actually. A lot of fractures. That was my recollection, though I suppose there must have been a lot of burns, too. I can remember there was one chap who whose nose just would not stop bleeding. And they were very, very, you know, he wasn't concerned. He said he didn't want to go. It was only a nosebleed. But it was a good thing they insisted, because he needed quite a lot of blood to compensate. And, you know, he had great problems stopping it. He'd obviously got some sort of fracture in there.
Was there much disease, you know, with the islanders? Were there...
Not a lot, no, no. They weren't too bad.
Was that surprising?
Well, there was in Rhodes. There was typhoid in Rhodes, very bad. We weren't, the old city was mostly out of bounds because of the typhoid, and we had a lot of typhoid cases when we opened a hospital. I went after all the patients were evacuated from Karpathos. We went over to Karsos, which is a very tiny island, where there were some refugees and no proper harbour. It was an absolute nightmare getting stuff ashore, only because they were expert and used to it. Was it at all possible? Great suitcases being hauled in off little tiny boats in great waves. I really don't know how they did it. And we were held up there because it was impossible to get boats in. Anyway, eventually we did arrive in Rhodes. And I was involved in... they'd already started. The person who'd been matron had been ill and had to go on sick leave, so I took over something that was already started in the Hotel Termi. It was being turned into quite a major hospital. And we had an enormous outpatients. The army used to grumble because the FAU doctors were so slow with these outpatients. But, of course, they all needed... They were civilians, you see, and they had needed tremendous amount of examination. I mean, an army... When you're examining chaps in the army, well, I mean, you know that they're basically healthy, and you know there are all sorts of things you haven't got to question them about, because either it's all there or it's absolutely self-evident. But, of course, examining civilians that have been starved for... living on an absolute minimal diet for possibly years rather than months, it's a very different matter. And some of them were very ill indeed.
Yes. When I think you've mentioned to me, you've seen the pictures of Belsen.
Yes.
How did these people, how would you rate their appearance
well,
and state?
Well, when I got there, they had already got a hospital for the starving, and they did compare with, you know, they were about comparable with the people in Belsen, some of them.
What, living skeletons?
Yes, yes. And it was, you know, they had to have the real very, very slow treatment back to anything normal. And we had that. By the time I got there, which was, I suppose, 6 weeks or so after the island had been relieved, things weren't so bad. The worst people had either died or got a bit better.
Did you form any impression of how these people had lived during the war years? You know, was it a case that they'd moved from island to island?
Really, what with the language difficulty and everything, I didn't really find out a lot. There were obviously the tensions between the Italians and the Greeks, because the Greeks felt the islands were theirs, but the Italians had been put there, and they were like the Chinese, overseas Chinese. They were mostly the brighter type of person. But the Greeks were getting very excited because they felt now the war was over, they'd go back to Greece. There was a Greek doctor and a group of Greek nurses came in early on. I think they were already there. I had awful language problems. That was one of the things that was I found so difficult. And I hadn't got the organising experience that really I needed for that type of job, because the ordinary everyday nursing was done very efficiently by these Greeks. I could support the doctors, but I wasn't really very good at the administrative side of things, especially as I was taking over from somebody who had made a jolly good job of starting it off, who hadn't been able to hand over to me because she'd already gone when I got there. Mm. She hadn't been well.
So the administrative side, what would that have consisted of?
Well, getting the ward routines organised and the actual patient care organised, and there was I don't know if he was American or English, wanted to get an operating theatre opened. That, unfortunately, didn't get going until after I'd left, because what happened, I wasn't in Rhodes so very long, and my husband was asked to go to China. This was before the war had actually ended.
Mm. Where had you met your husband?
I met him in Carpathos, and we'd thought, you know, we might think of getting married, but then when he was asked to go to China, we sort of hurried things up a bit and thought if I could go to China as well, that would be very nice. And I knew that Margaret, the Knight sister who'd gone out there, would have finished her 2 years, and I thought, well, surely there'd be a place for me in China. And my husband was asked because he had some X-ray experience with the FAU. They were making up teams in China, mobile teams to go, first aid teams to go right up to the front line of the fighting, which of course was with the Japanese and was still going on then. Of course, everything that happened very, very quickly then. Anyway, in spite of it, permission was given for me to travel with Eric. So he and I and several other people were taken from Rhodes back to Cairo to be flown home. And it was all delayed somewhat because of the end of the war, which came in the end of the war in the Far East that came then. Nevertheless, we did go home, although we realised these first aid teams wouldn't be wanted. By the time we'd got back to England, there was some delay. There was some work found for Eric, but they didn't put me in hospital to work in hospitals in England, because they thought they'd never get me out again with all the red tape. So I was a bit at a loose end. But eventually, we sailed for China in February to Bombay. That was a wonderful trip.
That would have been February 46?
February 46, yes. That was a wonderful trip.
Before I ask you about that,
yes.
I wonder if I could ask you a few more details about your earlier experience,
oh, yes.
You know, mm-hmm. in Egypt and Greece. You were obviously seeing the effects of war now, weren't you?
Yes.
Yes. How was that, you know, how was it impressing you? And did it create any dilemmas for your pacifism? Or did you find, on the other hand, it reinforced
no.
it?
No, it didn't. It didn't really create any dilemmas. An interesting aspect of it is that if you have an army in your country, you can scrounge from the army. There are always spin-offs from the army. The Yugoslav refugees were destitute because they hadn't got an indigenous. They'd only got a partisan army, and no supply. You know, there was no army with its own supplies from which they could get the spin-off. And the Yugoslavs were in a much worse state. In Italy, you know, with the armies there, was lots of scrounging could be done. In Rhodes, of course, they were isolated in the island. So they had been very, very deprived, because the Germans were deprived, so there was nothing for anyone. In Egypt, of course, the Egyptians were terrific scroungers, and it's with a large army that had been there for a long time. And really, the deprivation wasn't terribly obvious. The bombing in Italy was bad, of course, but in Egypt there wasn't much sign of war damage. The people I felt sorry for were the New Zealand soldiers you met, who hadn't been home had been away from home for 4.5 years. Those were the people I felt were deprived. That was, you know, where I made personal contacts like that. It seemed dreadful that people had been away from home with such bad communication so long.
But your earlier ideas about war, you know, which you were getting, as you explained, yes, the Bible, were these reinforced by what you had
yes.
seen?
Yes, it all seemed so futile. Prisoners and people being prevented from getting on with their lives and being sent away from home, and so much time and energy being sent on something that was so anti-productive. That, you know, it made you feel there must be some better way. Of course, some people's attitudes I found difficult, you know, to the other nationalities. Not so much to war as to the way people live and how right we were. Now I think about it, yes, I'm sure that bothered me more, how the British way of life was the way to live, rather than the actual business of pacifism.
Did it ever bother you, sort of working closely with the army?
No, it didn't really, no. I know, actually, when we were in Egypt, there were two doctors who'd been on the Anzio beachhead. They were Scottish. And their experiences there had really absolutely shattered them. And they did talk about them a lot. And that made a very great impression on me, the absolute horrors of a siege like that. Well, it was more, it really resulted in a siege, and how the carnage was so appalling, and the inability, the doctor feeling so absolutely useless, because you'd get a phone message to go somewhere, and by the time you got there, that area had been completely obliterated, and or the person you'd gone to see had bled to death or that sort of thing. That did make a very great impression. And it had affected him very badly. He was, you know, it was a pity all the little Yugoslavs were dying.
He'd have been much better if he'd been able to cure more of them
and see something a bit constructive happening.
Is how would you assess the FAU morale when you were in these various places? You know, did the FAU generally feel they were doing a worthwhile job?
I think so. Yes, I think morale was pretty high. I don't know. Perhaps some people got a bit frustrated because there wasn't an awful lot to do, and there were the sort of things that they liked doing were not available to them. The more intellectual things, you know, and of course, we had no money. It's so little money that you couldn't go off on much of a binge when you had the opportunity. Of course, I mean, a lot of the times we were very, very isolated and dependent on each other. We did get on, well, I don't remember there being fights, but then probably it was only the more extrovert people I mixed with, rather than the people who were probably feeling a bit more miserable, I wouldn't have come in contact with them so much.
It's interesting what you were saying about the very low pay.
Yes.
That you feel that when there was sort of access to goodies in marketplaces, towns,
yes,
that there was a bit of frustration.
I think there must have been. I know, I mean, I felt it to a certain degree. And I'm sure a lot of the chaps must have felt frustrated.
Because most of them, would they have been drinkers? You know, would they have enjoyed a drink or cigarettes?
They might have done. We had bars in our messes. We had the army ration of cigarettes. I dare say there was talk about whether we should accept that, but I think we did. I can remember. I mean, I smoked then, and I said, but 50 a week seemed a lot then, you know. Other cigarettes were always available at very low cost, because we got them from the army. I suppose people did buy those. So I think those that smoked were probably all right, but I expect most of their meagre money would have gone on that. So, you know, that's why we went used to go for the cheap opera seats, and a lot of people couldn't even afford that.
And would you say, you know, looking at it from your position as a woman, you know, with the FAU men, did they generally get on well, or were there ever conflicts?
I don't remember conflicts.
Were there any, you know, did the women, did you yourselves create problems, jealousies and rivalries?
No, I don't know. I don't think so, no. There were problems with the mere fact that we were women and had to have different accommodation and so on.
Were there many romances? You know, you met your husband.
Oh, quite a lot, I think, yes, yes. Not every... Yes, I suppose most people got married. One FAU girl was engaged to a soldier, and I can remember somebody saying, oh, dear, I don't think I could have married a soldier. And she did marry him. I've been in touch with her lately. Mm.
And would that have been condoned by the FAU sort of...
Yes, I think we were pretty broad-minded about that sort of thing. Although, as I say, I can remember a bloke saying, you know, he couldn't understand being a pacifist and marrying a soldier.
You mentioned earlier how you wanted to go to China. You know, would you say that there was an appeal about being part of, I think it was called the China Convoy, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, well, it was, actually, no. I knew very, very little about it. I had to really think very hard when they asked me why I wanted to go to China. I hadn't done my homework at all well. I realised that the war had been going on in China a lot longer than it had been in the West, and I felt that they certainly needed support for that reason, but I knew nothing, I think, about the split with the communists and all that, and had to learn very quickly. And, of course, the China convoy sounded tremendously romantic, and, I mean, from my experiences in the Middle East, I felt I could manage roughing it fairly well.
Were you getting reports of, you know, FAU activity in all the different theatres of war while you were in the Middle East? You know, did you know
no,
that there
I
was
don't
the...
think so. No, I don't remember hearing anything about the China convoy when we were there. There might have been something at headquarters, but I don't remember it.
So could I ask you now about your journey?
Yes. Well, of course, my husband had to go in the dormitories downstairs with the men, and I was in a cabin... Well, I was reading it up. I thought I was in a cabin for two, but that must have been another time. I was in a cabin with 10 other women. And I think I was... There was one married woman on board with a child. I can't remember that. They were mid-European and been prisoners of war, I think. So they even couldn't get a cabin together. So that was impossible. But we were able to be together on deck and so on. And, of course, it was a... Although it was winter, I don't remember being sick in the med or anything, although some people were. One chap, as soon as he got on the ship, went to his hammock and stayed there until we got to Bombay, I think. I mean, when we got into the Indian Ocean, it was beautiful. And we saw flying fish and dolphins. It was lovely. And we were able to eat together, in spite of this segregation for sleeping. And the meals were good. At least I seem to remember them as good. And... it was interesting coming through the Suez Canal because we had to go through in the day. They only let boats through at night, so you saw it all. So that was quite interesting. And we got to Bombay and had to arrange to get Bombay and had to go across by train to Calcutta. And that was my first experience of seeing beetle chewers and how they spit, and it's all red absolutely everywhere on the ground. And little families sitting, waiting for trains, little groups all over the place, and people lying down and going to sleep on the pavement in the station. You know, I suppose we'd seen that a bit in Egypt, but it was a bit more obvious. And with all this beetle spitting and the red, it was a bit more dramatic in India. Anyway, I don't think we had to wait long, and we got onto this train, and. It was like a boxcar with bunks at the side and an open area, and I think the bunks could be folded up in the day or made... Well, certainly that's all we had to sit on those. And when there were meals, when there was meals, the train stopped and we used to climb out and run along the track and get into the restaurant car. I seem to remember the meals were sort of very much mem sahib sort of affairs, you know, with being waited on and white napkins and everything very European. And it was an exciting journey right across India. We could see the Himalayas on one side sometimes, and we saw monkeys and other things, and the little Indian villages. It was a bit tedious. I think it was 3 days and two nights. And when we arrived in Calcutta, we were met by FAU people, and everywhere was terribly crowded, too many people. We stayed in some sort of hotel, I think. There wasn't room for us in the FAU hostel. Of course, it was very near Christmas time then, and we were in Calcutta over Christmas. We played that silly game where you go into groups and someone goes up and a word is whispered and you then have to draw it, and your team has to guess. Well, in my group, the word was Calcutta, and in my group, somebody just drew a dustbin and it was instantly guessed, a dustbin with everything falling out of it. We were able to go to one of the Gandhi prayer meetings while we were in Calcutta, and that was really fascinating. Absolutely crowds and crowds of people. We were able to be fairly near the dais, and well, it was exactly like the film of Gandhi. When I saw the film, I thought, that is exactly how I saw him. We were able to walk round the compound afterwards, and he came walking towards us, supported by his niece, I think it was, and a sister-in-law. And it was exactly as they did it in the film. And it was very moving. It was we couldn't understand it because it was in Hindi, but somebody wrote, well, I think Hindi, and one of his brother, son-in-law or somebody took it all down in another language as he spoke. And the crowds were absolutely enormous. He obviously, the strength of his personality was fantastic, because he was very frail. It was a wonderful experience. I think we flew off to China the next day, or certainly very, very close following that, which was a little plane, well, fairly small plane, and we had to come down somewhere in Burma to refuel. So that was my only time I've been in Burma.